Okay, well, so thanks a lot, Peter, for inviting me. And I'm looking forward to hearing the talks and working in the workshop. I don't work on adaptive movement that much. I work on the passive, random kinds of things. And I feel a little bit like a pretender. I'm also somewhat less theoretical than many of the other speakers. And so I'm hoping to kind of bring a broader brush view on what I think adaptive movements, and in my talk I'll call it adaptive dispersal just because that's my obsession, and try to couch it in the context of meta communities, which is what I think is really interesting as a broad framework for thinking about ecology. So just to sort of set the stage a little bit, what's a meta community? What we're thinking about in the simplest cases are situations where we have multiple patches, multiple local communities, and they're interconnected by the movement or dispersal of at least some of the organisms in those patches. The simplest way to think of this is to think of these local communities as patches, and one of the important things is to think about during our deliberations and during my talk is the degree to which these local patches differ from one another, or are they homogeneous patches? And in the context of what I'll be talking about, I'll be especially interested in the degree to which different patches have different communities in them, either different species or different relative abundances. A real meta community looks a little bit more complex. Is there a way to lower light a little bit? I like this photo because it shows some of the features that move us away from the cartoon that I started with. So this is an aerial photo of prairie potholes in Siberia. It's a beautiful photo to me. Each of these ponds is a distinct little patch. Some of them are big, some of them are small. You can see that they have different organisms in them. The color in here is different algal blooms in the different patches. So they differ in size, isolation, and the position relative to one another in the landscape. Some of these small patches are surrounded by big patches. Other small patches are isolated from big patches. The patches have different populations. The reason these patches have different colors can be either because there are different conditions in the patches. Some of them may be high in nutrients, others low, high in pH, or low in pH, something like that. Or that due to the sort of population dynamics and dispersal movement of organisms, they happen to have different organisms in them. It's likely that the species that inhabit this meta community differ in their responses to these environmental differences that might be abiotic. They also probably differ in how they interact with each other. These are the things that I usually think about. When I got invited here, I started thinking about this next set of differences among species. So some of the species, they probably differ in how they disperse. And some disperse passively. So for example, these algae are thought to disperse through spores that are blown about by the wind, perhaps randomly. Some disperse adaptively. For example, amphibians moving between patches probably know something about the landscape that they're living in, or odonates that fly around these ponds have a chance to sample the conditions in the ponds and may make decisions based on that knowledge. They probably follow different rules depending on their biology. They have different costs of dispersal, and they have different propensities to disperse. These are the kinds of things that could alter the simple cartoon that we currently have about meta communities. To help you think about meta communities, I find that it helps to think of three simple things that dispersal does to alter the behavior of communities that are embedded in a meta community. First of all, dispersal is important because it provides the colonists that move about in the meta community and fuel the process of community assembly, which species are present and when they get there. Second consequence of dispersal in a meta community is that they can be responsible for the maintenance of maladaptive source-sink relations that differ from the ideal free distribution that Peter was talking about. And the third one, which receives less attention by ecologists than the first two, is that dispersal is responsible for the patterns of gene flow that may affect the evolutionary dynamics of the species that we're thinking about. And that includes their abilities to adapt to local conditions, etc. So now what I thought I'd do in this talk is try to give you a sense of where I think meta-community thinking is today and how it could be directed by the kinds of questions that Peter raised. I'll talk about the current theoretical frameworks, and you'll see that they seem kind of naive and not up to the task of addressing these Siberian prairie potholes. I'll talk about, I'll sort of repeat what Peter said, which is that currently most of the work in meta-communities is based on this passive random dispersal kind of idea. I'll try to give you an overall sense of where empirical evaluations of meta-community thinking is based on a variation decomposition kind of approach. And then most of the rest of the talk will be a set of topics that I think are exciting in meta-community thinking that might be consequences to consider as we think about our deliberations. The nice thing about them is that they're a list, and so if Peter waves his hand, giving me enough time to sum up at the end, I can just skip to the end and stop my list. On the other hand, if I speak really fast, I can get through them. So in a meta-communities working group sponsored by NCES, we've sort of tried to review the various ways people had used the thought of meta-community and found that they sort of fell into four broad categories, which we called paradigms. I'm now calling them frameworks. Bob likes to use modalities of thought. In other words, we're not being very rigorous about what we mean philosophically here. The one that's received the most attention recently has been the neutral paradigm championed by Steve Hubbell and Graham Bell. The idea here is that species are equivalent, and the dynamics of these communities and the patches are, to the species anyway, equivalent to one another. They may differ to us, but not to the species involved. And so it stresses the role of stochastic demography and stochastic dispersal events in driving the dynamics in those communities. Another perspective on meta-communities that's a kind of a different way of thinking about them is based on the idea that dispersal between patches can create source-sink relations between them. And so a lot of species that might be present in a local communities are not actually self-sustaining local populations. And this may be an explanation for things like high diversity that, you know, to try to resolve the problem of Hutchinson's paradox of diversity or the plankton. A third perspective, which is the one that I came in to this question with this idea of species sorting. The idea here is that dispersal is important because it fuels the process of community assembly, but it doesn't support these sort of source-sink relations. Instead, it just accelerates the rate to which we get to what we would consider the assembly endpoints of local communities. Now, the final perspective is what we call patch dynamics. In this case, dispersal is low, so that this fueling process is inhibited by dispersal limitation. Lots of patches are inhabited by species that will eventually be outcompeted or could eventually be outcompeted by other species that just haven't gotten there yet. And this can happen either in homogeneous patches where there's opportunities for colonization competition trade-offs, or in a heterogeneous set of patches where there's where species that do well in one patch also do well in patches because their competitors have not yet gotten there. So I'll emphasize the species sorting, and then I'll sort of gloss over the details of these other approaches, just in the interest of moving the debate forward. So in the species sorting view of meta-communities, there's a lot of patches. They're heterogeneous. Each patch is predicted to be achieve its endpoint assembly state in a fairly, you know, rapid rate. That means that when we go out to sample them, that's what we should be seeing. And that means that there should be a correspondence between the species composition of local communities and the environmental conditions that characterize the variation of patches in the meta-community. If the endpoint if the assembly endpoints of these communities are single endpoints, meaning it's always the same list of species, then there should be no spatial structure in the meta-community. These kind of deterministic models of community assembly, however, can produce other possible things besides a single endpoint. They can produce alternate stable states, or they can produce assembly cycles where you go from community A to community B to community C back to A, etc. And if those exist, there might be some spatial patterning in the meta community. So the idea is that with species sorting is if you know the environment, you should be able to predict the composition of local communities. If we see spatial proximity effects, they may be due to these alternate stable states or endpoint cycles. It's interesting to contrast that with what you'd think about if you took some of these other perspectives. So if you took the neutral model, you went to a bunch of patches, and you said to the organisms present in those patches, all of these patches are the same, at least relative to one another. Demography, stochastic demography, and stochastic dispersal would be the important thing. And there'd be spatial contagion within such a system that would produce spatial patterning, but no environmental patterning. Under a view of mass effects, if you assume that these mass effects are stronger between patches that are closer together, then you might predict that you'd see both environmental variation explaining the variation in community structure and spatial effects related to proximity. In the patch dynamics model, it's a little bit complicated. Most of the models, the actual models that people have done with equations, with two exceptions, I have assumed that the patches are homogeneous, and so there's very little known about what the behavior of patch dynamic models are when patch heterogeneity is present. But the patch dynamics should also produce spatial contagion because nearby patches are likely to be, patches that are empty are likely to be colonized more by species that exist in other nearby patches. So in both the mass effects and in the patch dynamics perspective, we should expect to see spatial patterning as well as environmental patterning. And in the and another possibility is that the real world consists of a gamish of all of these, and we should see both spatial and environmental patterns. It's possible to think a little bit more about what would determine which of these frameworks, modalities, or paradigms you're in. And one attempt to do that is one that I did relating dispersal rate. And here, what I mean by dispersal rate is the rate of events per unit time per patch, but not per patch squared. So this is the rate at which dispersal events occur in a patch, number of dispersals incoming per unit time, but not divided by the number of patches in the community. I say that because the patch dynamic models use dispersal rate in the other sense. and the amount of environmental heterogeneity that the organisms in the community perceive. So if there's no heterogeneity among the patches, then the neutral model is an appropriate framework for thinking about these meta-communities over a broad range of dispersal rates. If the dispersal rates are really high and there is heterogeneity, we can imagine that the dispersal rates can support source-sink relations between heterogeneous patches and correspond to the mass effects type of view of meta-communities. If the dispersal rate is really low, we can think that it might correspond to the patch dynamic view, and if the dispersal rate is just right, it might be the species sorting perspective. And what we mean by just right can perhaps be related to two other rates. One is the extinction rate on a per population basis, per patch. And the idea is that if the patch, the rate of incoming species arrivals to a patch is lower than this background extinction rate, there will be this dispersal limitation in the assembly process. And so that would correspond to patch dynamics type, whereas if the arrival rate is higher, it might correspond more to species sorting or mass effects. The other one is the per capita death rate of individuals in the local patches. If the immigration rate is on the order of the death rate, then immigration can support substantial local populations, which may alter interactions with other species, whereas if it is not, then it's just a trivial incidentals that you see on occasion, but don't alter community dynamics. I've done one other thing in this figure, which is cheating. You'll see that the little oval I have for species sorting sneaks over the boundary where the death rate is equal to the dispersal rate. And the reason I've done that is because I thought that in the presence of adaptive dispersal, organisms that could disperse adaptively might still produce patterns consistent with species sorting and not produce source-sink relations between patches corresponding to the mass effects view. And that's basically the message of the rest of my talk. You can now go to sleep. So as Peter pointed out, most of the work in meta-community ecology has assumed that dispersal is passive, relatively uniform among species, except with this competition-colonization rate trade-off kind of hypothesis, relatively uniform among patches, and undirected by and large. There are some models in which that's not been the case, and Peter's worked on some of those, and there's been other work on that. But the reason I'm trying to stay within the framework of meta-communities is that I like the broad scope of questions that can be thought about within that framework that hasn't been addressed with these more carefully done models. So what I'm hoping to learn from this workshop is to figure out just how much I can argue that this little species sorting balloon sneaks over into the mass effects perspective. My guess is it could be substantial, and that's why I'm interested in what we do here this weekend. So let me talk a little bit about where we are from the empirical side of view things. I'll be talking about how the community composition is regulated by the environment versus space to try to figure out where we are with these four kind of general ideas about meta-communities. And I'll start with talking about with a paper from Carl Kutt, and he published in 2005, which motivated me to think about this. What he did was to say, well, if we take the community composition across a broad scale of patches that are close to one another in a meta-community, we can break down that variation in the composition into components that can be explained by purely environmental differences, purely spatial differences, meaning how far apart they are, whether there's patchiness in the landscape, or the collinearity between environment and space, which means we don't know what's causing the variation, and then the residual. It's important to think a little bit carefully about some of these inferences, because if we think about the purely spatial component of variation, where in Carl's approach, we're attributing it largely to the effects of this dispersal. But we know that many environmental variables, including the ones that we might not be tempted to measure, can have spatial patterning. So basically, they'll contribute to what we estimate as the spatial component. It's also, environment can also be contagious because of the ways that species interact with each other. And therefore, that component of variation is likely to be an overestimate of the actual spatial effects. We should also think about the what we are thinking about as the environmental effects. If there are variables that are not measured that we should have measured if we were better biologists or had more money or something like that, we might find that they are important. Another possibility is that dispersal is facilitated by environmental similarities between patches. Also that mass effects might be more similar if the environments are more similar. So the environment, what we're calling the purely environmental component is likely to be an underestimate of the environmental effects. So Carl's idea was that we could kind of have a little decision tree or a little decision table that would allow us to figure out if we had spatial structure or environmental structure, whether we were likely to be in patch dynamics, species sorting, mass effects, or neutral theory. Neutral, we would predict only spatial effects, no environment. Species sorting, we would predict environment, no spatial effects. And then the others would have a mixture of the two. And he tabulated 158 studies that provided this information needed to conduct these analyses, and he did them. He found that if he classified them into whether the spatial effect was significant or the environmental effect was significant, most of the studies, a majority, especially if you deleted the category that found nothing, corresponded to the species sorting. Quite a few of them had a mixture, and relatively few of them had only spatial variation. I found that it was interesting to try to look at this as a less dichotomous system and try to look at the continuum in this case. So I took the same numbers and I added two other studies. One was the data from Hubble's BCI studies in Colorado, Barro Colorado Islands, that are available online, and then one from my own work on ponds in Michigan. And what you see here is that if we plot the purely spatial versus the purely environmental components, we have a mixture of the two. It's interesting that the world is bracketed by Hubble and Leibold. So somewhere between the two views of species sorting and neutral dynamics is where the real world lies. It does occasionally seem like there is no spatial effects. And the Barro Colorado Islands actually have a statistically significant environmental effect. That's because there's a lot of data there. So just as a sort of a crude summary of all of this, species sorting is important and is probably a good starting point for thinking about meta-community ecology. But spatial effects are also important, and there's many possible things that we could think about that would cause those spatial effects. So the question that I asked myself in preparing to come to this talk is whether adaptive dispersal was important. One thing that seems obvious to me is that, at least in the crudest sense, if organisms are following ideal free distributions without the complications due to Lie effects and strange little factors like that, then adaptive movement of organisms and adaptive dispersal and habitat choice should reinforce the degree to which the distribution of organisms is associated with environment and not space. That also means that if a movement of organisms is adaptive, then the cost of dispersal are also going to be reduced. One of the phenomena that occurs in meta-communities with random dispersal is that if dispersal is really high, a lot of people die, or a lot of organisms die, just because they're stupid and they're dispersing and going into patches that are bad relative to the ones they were born in, which were at least good enough for them to be born. So that's going to reduce the effects of regional control on local communities. It also seems likely, and after listening to Peter's talk, even more likely, that there's a novel set of interactions among organisms that disperse with different types of modalities and under different dispersal rules that we are only vaguely, well, at least I'm only vaguely capable of perceiving. But yet, it also seems like this could affect the way we think about meta-communities. So from now on, I can be interrupted, or at least give me like a couple minutes to anticipate. I'm going to go through a list of topics that I think are interesting and try to get you to think about the scope of things that could be affected by movement, adaptive movement of organisms. First, I'll talk about trophic cascades. I won't talk about coexistence and similarity because that's a topic that most of us are used to thinking about. I'll talk about the rest. So the work on trophic cascades, I'll motivate this by talking about the work of one of my recent graduate students, Jennifer Howeth. She was interested in how dispersal in a meta-community could affect the strength of trophic cascades in local communities within that meta-community. And as a sort of a hypothesis, she contrasted what you might expect in a meta-community with the closed communities that come from the work by Harston, Smith, and Sabotkin's paper on trophic structure. So The idea is that if we have predators that affect herbivores, how important a trophic cascade is relates to how important the indirect effect on the herbivores' resources is. And there's two ways to think about trophic cascades in a meta community. One of them is called what we're going to call the spatial trophic cascade. That's when we contrast places that have the predator present or high density with the predator absent. So that would be we're contrasting two patches that differ in whether the predator is present or not. The other type of trophic cascade occurs when a single patch loses or gains its predator through time. So from the Harsin, Smith, and Sabatkin paper and the theoretical work by Oksanen et al., including Fretwell, we already have some general qualitative predictions about what the effects of trophic cascades are in the closed system if we manipulate through time the distribution of the predators. And so we know that lowest trophic level is expected to increase if the predator's predator increases. And in the case where we have dispersal, we don't really know exactly what to expect. So her study was an experimental study. She created meta communities involving three different patches. One patch had the top predator always present, a bluegill sunfish. The other one had the top predator always absent, no bluegill sunfish. And the third patch had the predator move in and out every 2 weeks to simulate the temporal trophic cascades. And these patches were interconnected by pumps and controls had pumps as well, but the pumps just recirculated the water. And there were three treatment levels. One was no dispersal. We just pumped water just to see if the pumps slaughtered things or something like that. 0% per week. Low dispersal, where the pumps move 5% per week, and high dispersal, which is 140% per week, that means 20% per day. So don't get the feeling that they were emptied and then new water and something strange going on. And we contrasted the biomass of the top predator, the herbivores, and the plants to look at spatial trophic cascades, comparing the case where the predator was always present with the predator always absent, and the temporal trophic cascades, comparing times when the predator was present with times when the predator was absent in the third community. A summary of the results is here. This shows a couple of interesting things. The top graph is the growth rate of the top predator under the average of the two fish in each case in the none, low, and high dispersal. And what this shows is that dispersal between patches helps the fish grow. So when the fish are in, there's no dispersal, the fish basically eat everything, and then they sit around and starve. If you have some dispersal, they get food from the other patches and they do better. What's interesting is that even with 5% per day, per week, 20% per week, sorry, no, 5% per week, the low dispersal still enhanced the growth rate of the fish. So that's a little bit surprising. The second panel looks at the effect of the predator on the herbivore biomass in the spatial trophic cascade and in the temporal trophic cascade. And what you see here is that for daphnids, at least, which is the main prey of the fish, the effects are negative, and they're somewhat bigger negative for the temporal trophic cascade than the spatial trophic cascade. And there's an indication that they might be greatest at intermediate dispersal rates. The interesting thing is the bottom graph, which shows the strength of the indirect effect on the plants. And you can see that the trophic cascade is, in the spatial trophic cascade, is high at intermediate dispersal rates for the spatial one, but only in the temporal at the no dispersal rate. So basically, at higher dispersal rates, there was a virtually no indirect effect of the top trophic level on the plant. So the temporal trophic cascade was buffered by dispersal. So spatial trophic cascades were strong in all dispersal treatments. And one of the interesting things was that even when we pumped 140% per week of the water between these tanks, there was no apparent homogenization. The temporal trophic cascades were strongly damped in the case of dispersal and did not depend on the amount of dispersal. But it says that dispersal can cause variability in the strength of temporal trophic cascades. And it's been shown that trophic cascades, temporal trophic cascades, vary in different ecosystems in different studies. So we can ask, what would adaptive dispersal do? The idea suggested by Kevin McCann is that if organisms disperse at different scales, this could affect also affect the strength of the stability of trophic cascades. And it's also likely that some of these effects depend on the dispersal abilities of different trophic levels related to each other and whether that's adaptive or not. How much time do I have? Okay. Let me think a little bit about this. So let's talk a little bit on the other side of trophic cascades and talk about eutrophication of trophic structure in lakes. Here, what we're interested in is the relationship between plant biomass and herbivore biomass under different productivity regimes. We already know from survey studies that, generally speaking, there's a positive relationship between the biomass of plants and the biomass of herbivores in lakes, and this is also true in grasslands and many ecosystems. And we know that, by and large, the main driver of this is something that affects the productivity of these ecosystems. In lakes, it seems to be the total phosphorus content of the water. The problem is that closed models of community structure don't predict this pattern very well unless you do strange things to them. So it's been kind of a paradox. When we look at experimental work where people do something to try to generate this pattern, we find that they also seem to fail in ways that match up with the theory. So for example, in lakes, people have done, there's a kind of a cottage industry starting with the extremely important experiments of Schindler, in which we put nutrients on one side of the lake, separated by a curtain or in mesocosms or enclosures or something like that. And we look to see what happens to the trophic structure. So in, for example, in the classic study by Schindler, one side of the lake was left unfertilized, the other side was fertilized with phosphorus. There was a huge algal bloom on the side that had the phosphorus, nothing in the other side. The interesting thing about this study is that there was no response by the zooplankton community in these lakes. So basically, we had a huge increase in the plants, no increase in the herbivores. A bunch of other studies, the ones in stars are whole lake experiments, the ones in circles are little enclosure experiments, show similar results. Increasing plants, nothing on the herbivores. On the other hand, there's another big group of studies that show exactly the reverse pattern. The herbivores respond, but the plants do not. So that doesn't correspond to the original pattern that we had. And a hypothesis that I developed based on a model that we could call the diamond food web or the adaptability hypothesis. Some of this work was also done by Bob Holt, Dave Tillman, and Jim Grover. Is that what may happen is that when we enhance the productivity of an ecosystem by adding fertilizer, we may get either a bloom in the plants or in the herbivores, as has been shown in these studies. But eventually, these communities will get colonized by something that will eat whatever that excessive population is. So if it's a big plant population, like on the green side of the curtain there, there's something in the world that will eat that stuff. It just isn't in that lake. And if we wait around for a little while, it'll get there and eat it, and that'll increase the herbivore biomass and decrease the plant biomass, moving it in this direction. Similarly, if we have a big response in the herbivores, that means there's plenty of resources around. A plant that's inedible to any of those herbivores could colonize, or a predator on that herbivore could colonize. And the idea is that this species sorting process is what brings generates that initial pattern. I tested that hypothesis in a set of mesocosms in which I set up mesocosms that had no dispersal, and then I had another set in which I exchanged both plants and herbivores every week at a rate, very small rate, about 1% per week. And I found that if we plot the chlorophyll against the zooplankton biomass, when these local patches are in a meta community, they generate the positive relationship between herbivore and plant, and not when the mesocosms are isolated. So I'm going to skip over that. Question is, what would adaptive dispersal do? And that hasn't been modeled, to my knowledge. A paper by Leuil and Leroux showed that different levels of adaptive change in plants versus herbivores, and in this case, adaptive change was through evolution rather than through behavior, could alter the patterns of trophic structure in relation to productivity. If the plants have a greater adaptability, then the idea that these models predicted the same findings that I found. If the herbivores have greater adaptability, then the patterns would look quite different from that, corresponding to these top-down models, such as the one by Oksanen et al. And if they have comparatively levels of adaptability, then the outcomes are just sort of all over the map. They depend a lot on the details of the dynamics. I'm going to skip over that. Except to highlight that in this case, I have no idea what adaptive dispersal would do to those findings. I imagine that Kevin will talk about food web complexity, and I was going to talk a little bit about dispersal, diversity, stability, also from the work of Jennifer. And that's because in meta communities, it's thought that dispersal rate would affect species richness by producing these mass effects in at intermediate levels, which would enhance diversity at intermediate levels. Peter also talked a little bit about that. Leroux et al. Thought about this question a little bit and also predicted that the stability of ecosystem attributes of that community could also depend on dispersal rate, because in the presence of mass effects, there'd be more likely to be compensatory dynamics among organisms in response to environmental fluctuations or disturbances. So in the same experiment, Jennifer looked at this relationship, and she found that at intermediate dispersal rates, there was higher diversity at the regional scale and at the local scale. And that there was an effect of predators reducing diversity, but there was no interaction. And there was an interaction, I'm sorry. What was interesting was to look at the temporal variability at the regional scale and at the local scale. And in both cases, the temporal variability went down at the intermediate dispersal level, suggesting that the effects of dispersal could mediate stability through these effects of diversity. So we can ask ourselves, what would adaptive dispersal do in this case? Based on some of the thinking by McCann et al., the idea is that it would increase the stabilizing effect, and especially might be able to extend it to the case where dispersal is at high levels, so that even at high levels, the dispersal effect would increase the stability, as opposed to the experiments that we did, which was passive dispersal. Basically the theme I've tried to develop is that it would be interesting to meta community ecologists to think about adaptive dispersal and adaptive movement. And maybe one way to guide the way we think about that is to come back to these three roles that dispersal plays in meta community ecology. First, they provide colonists that fuel the community assembly. We can ask ourselves, how does adaptive dispersal alter the dynamics of these occasional colonizing events? I don't think that's been thought of very much. And I think in order to tackle that question, you probably have to think about spatial autocorrelation across broad spatial scales. Second question, second component is that dispersal supports maladapted sink populations where they, that would otherwise go extinct. It seems like adaptive dispersal would probably reduce the likelihood of that happening quite substantially. And the third process that's affected by dispersal is the processes that involve gene flow and their consequences for evolution. And I hope to hear more about that from some of the speakers. And I'll take your questions. Thank you very much.